Well, thanks for joining me today. I have Sue Martens. She has her PhD in medieval studies. She is the visionary founder of the Jungian Center for the Spiritual Sciences. I've asked her on here today to talk a little bit about her career, her interests in Carl Jung, the Jung Center for Spiritual Sciences. And she's written a lot of essays on that website, which I have read over a period of time. So I would like to ask her some of those questions too. So, Dr. Sue, or Sue, thank you for joining us today.
Just don't call me late for supper, right?
Yes. Yeah, it's good to thank you for coming on. I'm excited for this conversation. Have you ever done a podcast before?
Pardon, have I ever?
Yeah, have you ever done a podcast before?
Well, the people have suggested this, that I should do this. And again, this is like a tech thing that I don't know much about. I'm open to doing them, but somebody else would have to deal with the technology, as you have seen.
Well, I applaud your openness to a new experience and the courage to try it out. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, I can say that I definitely am surprised in the years now that have passed that I've been involved with Jung, because I started out in life as to wanting to be a teacher, and went to college with that idea in mind, and then a college professor, and I was a college professor, and typical of the sort of mindset of the Ivy Leaguer, had no interest in psychology at all. Until November 25th, 1983, when I had the first of what I've come to call my voiceover dreams. They're not any regular dream, it's just words. And in that first one, it said, friends will die, relatives will die, you will give up everything, and your life will be transformed. So I was married at the time. I woke up and I said, Ed, did you hear that? I mean, this huge voice. And he said, no, I didn't hear anything. So then I told him. And then, of course, given my, Ivy League mindset, this was just so much a folderol, and I forgot it. And then 5 days later, I learned my friend Hazel Crafts had dropped dead the night before. And within 6 months, I lost another friend, an aunt, an uncle, and everything in my life began to fall away. That dream was predictive. And since then, now that was 1983, so we're talking, 50 years ago, 40 years ago, I've had many of these dreams and they direct my life. And it was July of 2005 that I had a whole series of dreams over the course of a week that set up the Jungian Center. Yeah, and that's how it came to be. Now, when I started having these dreams in 1983, I was teaching at College of the Atlantic in Bar Harbor, Maine. And when it became obvious this dream was, exactly what it said, I thought I was losing my mind because this wasn't how life was supposed to be. And I went to everyone that my friends could recommend. I even went up to the psychiatrist in Bangor because I really thought I was going crazy. And I had all these dreams and I kept putting them in a journal and I would show them to people and they say, oh, if you're having all these dreams, you should work with a Jungian. Now, I'm so out of it, Daniel, that I'm hearing the word UNION. So I'm thinking there's some kind of dream workers union that I have to get in touch with. So I kept hearing this, and finally I said to this one fellow that, was the third or fourth psychologist that had mentioned this, where is this union? I can't find a dream workers union. And he said, no, it's not union. It's Jung because he was a German speaking Swiss. So it's Jungian. So then I go to the college library there at College of the Atlantic, and I discover this fellow has an entire bookcase of books. I mean, they're behind me here in this this is, you know, my office, and those are all Jung.
Wow.
And then that's how I found him. And I started reading, and he was, you know, discussing exactly what I'm going through. So I said, I've got to find a Jungian. But that's 1983, 84. There were none. Nobody could tell me there was a Jungian analyst working in Maine. So then, let's see now, this is May of 85. I heard about The Way of the Jung, the movie, was going to be offered as a weekend at Bowdoin College. And so I went, and I figured there'd probably be Jungians there, because by this point I knew about Marie Louise and how she, you know, did this video series. And so sure enough, a woman named Chandler Brown, very well networked in the Jungian community, said to me, because I said, is there anybody in Maine? She said, I think I heard somebody recently is going to move to Maine. Let me follow through, take your phone number, and I'll call you. And that was May. So July, I think it was like July 15th, I show up on Linda Schmidt's doorstep. She hadn't even unpacked yet. And there I am, you know, saying, I'm going to work with you. And she was my first analyst. I have subsequently worked with three men over 38 years. But that's how it started.
Wow.
It was the best thing in the world I thought of.
That's a fantastic story. I love it.
Rather bizarre.
Yeah. What did you, when you came across all of Jung's writings, do you remember where you started? Nowadays, you could probably just Google Jung's writings on dreams, and it might give you a good starting place. But do you remember like where you started or what that was?
Well,
like?
Apropos that, given the 38 years now I've been in this, I actually wrote, and it is number one on the Google searches, A Beginner's Guide to Reading Jung.
Oh.
Because over the years, I've had people come to me and they look shell-shocked, you know, like, because they started with one of his alchemical works.
Yeah.
And that would be like you're going to play the piano and you start with a Beethoven sonata. I mean, not to be recommended.
Yeah.
So I generally suggest to people that you start with things like memories, dreams, reflections. I think probably I went to the college library to his volume 20, looked up dreams, because that's what my focus was, and started with one of the books that dealt with dreams, perhaps maybe 8, 10, but one of the easier ones.
Yeah.
So.
And what was it like for you when you, your first analyst, you showed up on her doorstep, she hadn't unpacked yet. What was it like for you working with her, and did she, what was it like working on working through your dreams? How was that process?
Well, first off, she was, as you might imagine, rather surprised at my history, you know, and how I had been searching for her for 2 years, and how I had all these dreams, and I still had these strange dreams that tell me what's going to happen. But she was very open-minded and flexible. She, as it turns out, was the daughter of Joe and Jane Wheelwright, who analyzed with Jung himself and founded the Jung Institute in San Francisco.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and she had just moved from San Francisco.
Ah.
So she was, you know, really quite open-minded and rather intrigued by somebody that was having these strange dreams and clearly valued them, because I had, you know, a big thick notebook by that point.
Yeah. That's interesting. I've never, you labeled it, you said it's voiceover dreams. I've had dreams before where the dream is only, it's only language, and it's in like a language that I don't really understand. Like but in the dream, I feel like I understand these words, but when I wake up, I can't remember what it was talking about. That's the closest I've ever, and I've never heard of I've never looked it up or anything, so it's interesting to hear you talk about this and yours, like it was very clear and then it ended up coming to pass. Yeah, quite mysterious.
Yes, right. And initially, of course, as you might imagine, I didn't like this one bit.
Yeah, terrifying.
Yeah, I mean, and they were telling me precisely what I did not want to hear.
Of course.
It was really most unpleasant.
I ask where were you at that time? The first time you had this dream, it seems like you started to describe how you were more, Ivy League kind of scientific mindset, perhaps. Where were you religiously?
Pardon, what was
Where were
I?
you like religiously?
Well, I had, when I moved to Maine, and this was in 19, let's see, I guess it would be 1977. And I went deliberately, I didn't go into Bar Harbor, which is where the college was, because it was very commercialized. And I went to a small town, Southwest Harbor, on what they call the backside of Mount Desert Island. And I got involved in the community there, which at that time had a nice, fairly liberal UCC church. So religiously, I was involved with them. And by 1983, they had gotten a minister who was quite conservative. And that's when I left. But I've always had a religious background in the sense of general mainline Protestant religion, rather like Carl Jung, and have subsequently come to realize that it's really an internal thing, as he's speaking about, the spiritual adventure of our time is finding the God within.
So at that time then you like were you raised religious at all?
I'm sorry, what was I?
Yeah, sorry. Were you raised religious at all?
Yes. Oh yeah. Yeah. I my mother taught Sunday school. When I got older, I taught Sunday school, and yeah, so I had a religious background.
Yeah.
And of course, medieval studies, you get even further into it because religion was a theme through that time period.
Yeah.
So
Was it when you started learning about Jung, did your religious views change with Jung?
well, they were changing before that, as I said, I
Okay.
that strict, biblical literalism sort of thing.
Yeah.
And then as I got further into Jung, but also as I began to really trust this voice or whatever the source of the voice is,
Yeah.
then it became re very real to me because I think Jung had the same, I don't think he had voices, but I think he had intuitions that he recognized came from the self.
Yeah, okay. And how old were you when you had that first voiceover dream?
Okay, so let's see. I was 80, because I'm 78 now, so I was 38 then, I guess.
38. That's interesting too, 'cause I haven't studied Jung nearly as much as you have, but I do know that a lot of it was talking about the second half of life and it happens in your later 30s. And yeah, so that's interesting.
That's right. Yeah, this was, and I came later then also to astrology again, blowing my socks off. The idea that, a Yale PhD who gets into astrology, right? I had Uranus opposite Uranus. It's the classic midlife crisis when Uranus comes between, age 32 to maybe 42. You have the Uranus transit, and there it was, smack dab. And it was in a place where, of course, my career, my home, my marriage, everything about myself would change because Uranus was hitting all the major angles and many of the major planets. So,
Oh, fascinating.
es la sfortza del destino, as they say,
What is that?
the force of destiny.
Oh, okay. Can you tell me about the voiceover dreams that led to you establishing the Jungian Center for Spiritual Science?
Yeah, as I said, it wasn't just one. It was a whole series over a week. And it started with one that said, set up a school. And that was great. I mean, oh, wow, that's what I want, right? But then it went on. And it went, you're going to have five paths of the curriculum, not a regular school, you know, like you have philosophy and you have physics and stuff. This was going to have five paths, the Via Creativa, creative path, the Via Physica, a physical path, the Via Contemplativa, the contemplative or meditative path, the Via Cognitiva, the cognitive or intellectual path, and I'm blanking on the fifth. Physical, the investigative, but there were five paths. Now I got all this, I wrote it all down, and then I'm typical of these voiceover dreams. I said, I can't possibly do this. You know, I don't know anything about meditation. I don't know anything about physical health and healing. But then I had a thing that an intuition said, well, you don't have to do it alone. And I said, oh, okay, so we'll collect faculty. So then the next, that was the first, was set up a school. The second was to do the paths. The third night, gave me the mission and the values. The mission, of course, is to disseminate the work of Carl Jung. And then the values follow, you know, small, because he had, you know, a thing about mass-mindedness. So we make a premium of being small, being very personal-oriented, you know, so there's a whole thing of values, and I wrote all them down. And then the next night, the final night, that was the fourth or the fifth night, was to make it a nonprofit. So with that set of descriptions, and then, of course, I ran this by Linda Schmidt, you know, the analyst, because she was getting all my dreams. And she said, it sounds very exciting. So that was like the imprimatur, you know, of some person that, you know, knows this better than I do. So then I took myself off to a lawyer and got set up as a nonprofit. And then the first year we had, the first course I taught was, as you might imagine, a course on dreams.
Nice.
And that basically drew a series of friends of mine, because they knew I was all hepped up on this. And so, you know, the excitement was infectious.
Yeah.
But then began the process of actually getting the 501c status from the IRS, for which the lawyer said, you have to have at least a year's worth of work to show them what you're doing. And because we wanted to be a school, we had to have all the, you know, Americans with Disabilities Act, you know, and all these, you know, boilerplate. Boring. So I spent the whole summer, the next summer, doing all this paperwork and finally sent it off. And we got our designation as a 501c3. But by then, people were asking, because there was nobody around here in Vermont that was doing Jung stuff, they wanted courses. So then I started to develop courses. And I've done that right along. Oh, and then the next thing we had to do was develop a website, about which, of course, you have seen. I know nothing. But the guy said, you have to keep putting stuff on it so that the search engines find you. So I started writing blog essays.
Okay.
I have 193 now.
Wow.
On one every month since 2008.
Wow. Yeah, that's actually how I found, I was curious what Jung had to say on prayer. And it's one of the, your website, your essay on that is one of the first things that came up when I searched it. And then I was like, oh, wow, there's so many essays on here. And then I thought it was maybe, yeah, some kind of an institution, some type of, maybe a lot of different people contributing. And then on one of the essays, it said this was written by Sue Mertens. And I was like, oh, so then I found you. And here you are.
Resourceful. Yes,
Yes.
indeed.
Yeah.
Very good.
Well, that's really exciting. I love how one, I love that you had these like terrifying dreams and you sought out the meaning of them. You sought out a Jungian and then you followed through and you did something that I think has brought a lot of, I'm sure, a lot of value and a lot of resources to people who were in need of that. I think that's awesome. Do
Yeah,
you know?
it has definitely met a need.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about the need that it has met? And do you know, like, do you keep numbers on how many people have gone through or how many courses you've taught? What kind of courses you're teaching? Like, what are the most requested courses, stuff like that?
Well, clearly the most requested and the one I love best is the one I did first, and that's Dreams. Because I think in a lot of people's minds, Jung is associated with dreams. And so that's our favorite course. I've taught that the most because we were, until March of 2020, local. I always had to create new courses because there is a small, Vermont is a small state. And so if I repeated, we wouldn't have people because, oh, I've already taken that course. So I've created a great number of courses. Now we have some, the tech guys always give me these stats, but there are thousands of people now because after March of 2020, where we had to go to this Zoom thing, we now have people all over Australia, Argentina, France, Britain, Canada, all over the United States. It's amazing this medium, as much as I say tech is a four-letter word. I really think it's wonderful that we're able to broaden it out. And now the curriculum basically is student-generated, meaning they ask for a course, and either I or somebody that, is around willing to teach it will create the course.
Wow. I saw a comment or a review, something that was saying how basically someone will request a course, and in the matter of no time at all, you will have researched, put everything together, and you'll teach the course. Like, and they're like, she's amazing. I don't know how she does it so quickly.
I think that's just experience. When you've been teaching for 50 years, I started teaching college in 1969. I think that's actually probably more than 50 years, but you get to be pretty good at, pulling together resources and then figuring out, what you're going to teach. Our courses here are rarely like college courses in the sense of 15 weeks with, multiple hours every week. With exams, we have no exams. There's no pressure for people. I just am right up front. I say I don't expect anybody to do the homework, but you would get more out of the course if you did the homework. But I don't expect that of people. I hope that they come in and they have enthusiasm, and that I've seen to be the case.
Great. How much did your studies in medieval, how much did your medieval studies aid your understanding of Carl Jung and alchemy and things like that?
That's the amazing thing, Daniel, because I majored in medieval studies because I like Latin and I like that period of history. Now, as I look back, I'm so glad because at heart, Jung was himself a medievalist. And alchemy is one reflection of his, medieval interest. And of course, that meant that I had all the languages because we had to have Latin, Greek, French, German, all these various languages that he used. And so it's proven to be a great blessing for a young scholar.
Wow. I've heard, I don't know if this was a quote by him, but I've heard, I think it was attributed to him, but basically, if you want to understand Jung, you need to know Latin, Greek, and you need to know the Bible. And
Oh, yes. Yeah. And in fact, there's one in my book on reading Jung, one of the ones I've written that's his biography. I said, if you want to get into the alchemical works, you need to have Latin, Greek, French, German, a bit of Sanskrit, a bit of Arabic. You need numerology, mythology, astrology, at, you have to study the Gnostics, and it goes on and on and on and on and on. I mean, very few people have that degree of background.
Yeah, that's honestly, it can feel a bit discouraging because I feel like I would love to strive for that, but I don't know if I'll ever attain that level of study, you know?
Yeah, and that's why I feel grateful to have gone through all that. You know, as an undergraduate and then a graduate student, as I look back, I sat in Beinecke Library, the rare book library at Yale, reading some of the Incunabula, the ancient, very expensive volumes that Jung actually used.
Oh, wow.
So,
That's awesome.
yeah,
What are the chances?
I know. Nope. Amazing.
I feel like I'm kind of jumping all over here, but why did you name it the why the Jungian Center for the Spiritual Sciences?
Again, that came to me. And it the spiritual sciences, I want to, I never, I know now I never question these dreams, but they usually come and I'm like, what the hell with spiritual sciences? So I looked it up. Science, of course, I know is the Latin word, and it simply means learning. It comes from scioscere, to know or to learn. And here we're learning the spiritual sciences defined broadly to encompass more than just formal theology. And Jung didn't really have much use for theology. It was, you know, set down in one of these voiceover dreams I had.
With today's, I think, current culture, focusing a lot on the scientific method and materialism, how might the Jungian Center for Spiritual Sciences stand in contrast to that? And what did Jung think about materialism and such?
Yeah, well, needless to say, he had a lot of problems, and that was one of the problems he had with Freud. You know, scientific materialism was not Jung's way at all, because he recognized that materialism denying the spiritual aspect of life. I mean, Freud went so far as to call religion an illusion. And Jung had no truck with that. He recognized religion was an instinct, religio, our inner need to reflect, to contemplate, to wonder, you know, how do I fit into the, you know, the all? This is a basic human instinct. And so Jung had no use for that scientific system, but he was very much a scientist, and he called himself a scientist. And he took Jung, Freudian, the Freudian method to task because they're dogmatic and they are ideological and they work from a deductive position where they have a theory and then they get everything to support the theory. Jung was a true scientist in being inductive. He would have experience. He would observe his experiences as an empiricist. And then from that, he would formulate a hypothesis, and then he'd have more observations to see if the hypothesis was true. And that's the scientific method. And then if you look at some of his work, like his thoughts about entropy. Entropy is a key part of, you know, thermodynamics. It's why if you have a coffee and you set it on the table and then forget about it, it's cold by the time you go to drink it. That's entropy. But there's something called psychological entropy that he understood that we can use in our work to foster our growth. And I wrote an essay on that, psychological entropy, or why you don't want to get everything you want right away. Because the difference between where you are and where you want to be creates that, what would you say, sort of like a power to move you there. Mm-hmm. Like the difference between the Mississippi River and the Niagara River, which one has more power potential? Because there's a big difference between here and here.
Yeah.
He recognized that. And so he would hold out to people that were complaining about this is going so slowly. You know, why am I not healing? You know, what's going on? He would say, value the fact that you're not there yet. Because there's this difference between where you are and where you want to be. And that's a power, that energy can help you move faster toward healing.
I like that. I haven't thought of it in that way before. I've heard like you've got the past that's pushing you and you've got the future that's calling you. Mm-hmm. But I've never thought about that like maybe like the tension between where I am now and where I want to be.
That's right.
Oh, that's cool.
And there's energy in that tension.
And I know he defined the libido as being more of this energy.
Psychic energy.
Is that the same type of energy, or are there different kinds of energies?
Well, see, that was another sticking point between Freud and Jung, because Freud was hung up on sex. So it had to be sex. And when Jung came out with CW5, Symbols of Transformation, he had by that point come to realize that libido is general energy. And it's not just limited to sexuality. And that's when, because Freud was absolutely dogmatic, that's when you knew I'm going to have to break with Freud. And he told Emma, you know, they were both sad by the fact that he knew Freud was going to cut him off. And he did.
Where was it? Hang on. Where did it go? I had a good question. Can you talk a little bit about, I've heard about active imagination. It's still something that I'm trying to understand more about, but do you ever use that? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, Jung called active imagination dreaming the dream forward. And I was introduced to it, of course, in my first analysis, and they all of the subsequent analysts have used it, where you have a dream and there's no what's called lysis, L-Y-S-I-S. It's the Greek word for a resolution or a conclusion. And, you know, you're like being chased by some big monster and you're running, 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 and then you wake up. So, I mean, did you get eaten? Or did he kill the monster? Or did he run off a cliff? You know, we don't know. So what you do in active imagination is go back in your mind's eye to the situation. But instead of just waking up, you can, because you are awake, you're semi-awake, you see what happens and how does that transform? Because many times in that particular, that's a sort of classic, you know, you're being chased by something scary. Jung found that what is chasing you wants to come to you because it has some gift or wisdom or message. But you don't try to make anything happen because it's that paradoxical thing he called wu-wei, action through non-action. But you just allow what wants to happen, happen. And in many cases, he found that the monster would say, you know, here, I have something for you. And then he would hold out a gift. Or in one case, in my own life, I had a dream of a woman, and the analyst said, well, now come back, bring that woman back up in your mind and see what happens. And she started talking to me. And it was, you know, wise words that I needed to hear, but I had woken up before, you know, she got to speak. So it dreams the dream forward so that you can get more, what would we say, juice or energy out of the dream.
Okay. That makes sense. That's helpful. And it makes me think of how you said, of course, the voice of our dreams were all pointing you towards something that you didn't want to move toward, like the monster chasing you, but it just wants to give you a gift, but we're scared, so we run away, you know. the question I wanted to ask earlier, you were talking about Jung and his libido theory versus Freud's, and with Freud being maybe having a materialistic worldview, have you heard of metaphysical idealism or philosophical idealism, and is that what Jung would be classified as?
Possibly. I think he'd be open. I say possibly, again, he was very empirical and very much concerned to be a scientist. So for him, metaphysics, which veered into intangible stuff, was dicey.
Okay.
And he definitely did not like being called a mystic or a metaphysician, and he didn't want to get into metaphysical discussions with philosophers because they just go off into the ethers.
No.
He liked to stay with what he could see or observe or intuit, and virtually all his philosophy, his theories and his personal philosophy derived from his work with his patients, where he could see the psychic things, you know, emerging. And that's how he got into alchemy. You know, people say, what in the hell did he get into alchemy for? He really liked to read the alchemists because they were describing their personal structure of the unconscious. And that's what he really wanted to understand. And these, there were so many of them, he had a lot of material that he could draw upon. But it does get some degree down into the, you know, wormhole if you're not, you know, prepared to adopt an alchemical mindset.
Yeah. I think I'm just trying to figure out, like, there are some people who say that if they're a materialist, they say consciousness comes from the complicated interplay of your neurons firing, and it gets so complex that it creates consciousness or something. I'm trying to understand, like, Jung was very much an empiricist, and he also believed in the self and the collective unconscious and this kind of universal consciousness or unconscious. So I think I'm just trying to understand, is there like a philosophy or a label that he would fall into? Like, materialist, idealist, dualist, I don't know.
I call myself a Jung scholar.
Yeah.
and that's true. I mean, I basically study, you know, all 20 volumes here and other things that have been written, you know, by and about him. And I would say I tend to like the idea of science rooted in personal experience. So to that extent, I'm rather like Jung.
Yeah. Okay.
Now, calling myself a Jung scholar means that I don't fit anywhere.
Yeah.
Because I'm not an analyst, never wanted to be. But the Sylvan Grooves of academe, as opposed to the Sylvan Groves of academe, don't have many places for Jung scholars. He's considered, you know, woo-woo, mystic, and they dismiss him. But fortunately, I don't need to have the imprimatur of a formal academy. And there are people that ask if we're going to go to the legislature and get, you know, accreditation.
Oh, really?
heaven forfend. I mean, we teach astrology, we teach numerology, you know, we teach all this woo-woo stuff. I don't think even the Vermont legislature would credit that.
Yeah, can you talk a little bit about where do you see the center going? What are the plans for the future?
Well, I'm 78, so this is something that the board is discussing, you know, quite avidly, because there aren't too many young scholars. So it's not like, you know, they're just going to call up the local employment agency and, you know, give us five people we can look at. So I think it's probably going to go into be something like a study center, because, you know, where we're located here, we have an excellent library, and we could do that. Possibly we could do something similar to what they do up in Brunswick, Maine, where three or four times a year they bring people in to give, you know, weekends or courses of a short duration. And apparently Brunswick, you know, is able to survive that way. And so I think that, you know, is what we might do. But it is something that they're, you know, concerned about.
Yeah. Do you have a hope?
Do I have a hope?
Uh-huh.
Well, I certainly hope it would continue in some form. Is it going to be in this form? No, because I don't know that we'd have that many people who could teach the things I teach.
Yeah.
With the background I have, I mean, I don't think they're going to easily replace me.
No.
But there are people who could teach, you know, a course or two periodically coming to Vermont. I mean, there are worse places to be in the world than Vermont in September and October.
Yeah. You've written a few books. Do you have any books in mind that you are hoping to write in the near future?
I don't know. But again, see, I don't really feel that I've written what I've written because I've had dreams that have laid out the topic.
Uh-huh.
And basically, I just sort of stand by and, you know, get my marching orders and set to it and get it done. So I think that I'm now working on courses. And again, many of them come from student recommendations or ideas that I get at night. But I don't have any burning desire to write a book that's from my own, you know, what I've generated myself.
Yeah. I was just curious if you feel like someone coming from your background, with your history, with your knowledge of language, with your all of the knowledge that you've gained about Jung through your Jungian scholarship process, if you feel like, you know, before it's my time to go, with all of this, this is what I want to impart, or this is what I want to share, that maybe someone who doesn't have all of this background or knowledge of languages can read this and then, you know what I mean?
A valedictory, perhaps. Well, I don't know. I'm open to the idea.
Yeah.
And I, as I say, if I get that sense, you know, to write something like that, I would.
Yeah. Okay. Well, if you have the sense or a dream soon, you're welcome. I'm just kidding. Can you sorry, one more question. Well, I mean, not the last one, but for people, especially in Jung's time, from my understanding, he dealt a lot with people who no longer felt like they could believe the religion that they grew up with. And they started having a lack of meaning or felt out of sorts because of that. And I think he said something along the lines of, for people who can get back into a religious structure or a church, or if they can belong to that, then good. But for people who can't, what maybe advice or what direction might you steer someone like that?
Well, he went back. One of the themes that runs through Jung's life from the time he was like 11 was getting corroboration from wise people who had gone before. So all his life, he was interested in history, interested in philosophy, and he found people who had written about the experiences they had and what they discovered that paralleled experiences he had. Now, one of these people was the 12th century monk Joachim de Flores, who had this idea that there were three ages in terms of Western spiritual development. First was the age of the Father, represented by the Old Testament. The second was the age of the Son, represented by the New Testament. And that was as far as, you know, Joachim was alive. But he hypothesized that there would be an age of the Holy Spirit where there wouldn't necessarily be a book, but that people would live the internal awareness of the Holy Spirit. And he called that the age of the Holy Spirit. Now, Jung had this notion, you probably knew he was considered to be the father of the New Age movement, because he studied astrology, and he recognized that we were moving from the age of Pisces, which started about the time of the birth of Christ, up to about 2,000 years. And there would then be an age of Aquarius. And Jung hypothesized that we were already in the overlap between the Piscean and the Aquarian age. Now, as we get further into the age of Aquarius, Jung felt, more and more you would see people moving into that age of the Holy Spirit. And Jung hypothesized, well, actually, and it's been proven, that more and more churches would become empty. People would vote with their feet because the old age of the sun bit was not feeding their spirit, where evolution, in evolutionary terms, they had moved. And we see this. And it's obvious to me, especially Vermont, we have the 24% of Vermonters actually go to church. It's the least churched state in the country, very similar to Europe. And so these beautiful buildings are being, you know, repurposed as boys and girls clubs, and you know, community centers, you know, all this stuff, because they're no longer feeding the soul of the modern man. But that doesn't mean that people still don't have a spiritual need. And Jung was concerned that people began to really develop support systems for their spiritual need. And he wrote, he gave a series of Terry lectures at Yale in 1936. And I use them as the basis for that book, The Spiritual Adventure of Our Time. And if you want, I can send you a copy of that. But it basically talks about how we are shifting from the old age of the sun to this age of the Holy Spirit.
Did with with the shift to the Holy Spirit, like the age of the Holy Spirit, where people would hopefully be guided by their inner selves, like the self, instead of maybe a book or authority or the, you know, the pastor or something like that. With that shift, are there any like guidelines or general advice on how to go about doing that?
Oh, yeah. And Jung goes right back to the source. The source here is Jesus, who says, you don't want to lay up treasures on earth where moths and rust consume and thieves can break in to steal, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven. And that's basically what the age of the spirit will be about. You lay up treasures in heaven. Now, everybody, given our materialism, they focus on treasures. Oh man, I'm going to be rich, right? I'm multimillionaire. Let's go for it. But Jesus and Jung would put the strength on lay up because it's a process over time of trusting your intuition and your dreams and synchronicities. And even your physical body to give you guidance. Because Jung recognized from his own life that every day we're getting guidance, but we're asleep. Or we may be literally asleep, but even when we wake up, we tend to get so busy and so preoccupied. And, we're such an extroverted culture that it's all out there. And Jung would say you want to develop what works for you. Some people meditate, that's good. And some people will respond to beauty and produce beauty or music or something in the arts that feed the soul. And some people will be prayerful, however that works for them. But the key was it's unique to you. It doesn't have to be like anybody else. You are the authority, or yourself, Jung would say, capital S self, that inner divine wisdom ultimately is your authority. And the process is one over time. In other words, you don't develop trust in a day or a week, or in my case, 10 years. But you have to understand, Daniel, I was a real blockhead. But in time, you realize, okay, this is going to work out. I've had this directive or I've had this intuition. I know I can trust it. And that's the key.
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you. Would you classify Jung as a moral relativist?
Oh,
What did
yes,
he
definitely.
most
Oh,
definitely?
definitely. Oh, yeah. Yeah, he came right out and said as much because he traveled a lot. He came to North America 6 times. He went to Africa multiple times. He went to India, traveled all over Europe. And he recognized that different customs and morals and mores relate in different places. And if you become your own inner authority, which is what he would want people to do, that's part of the process of individuation, which was, one of his big things, you develop your own moral code. Now, if you're really working in individuation, it's going to be a very high and rigorous moral code because when you're individuated, you recognize we are all connected. So if I do something bad to you, I'm doing something bad to me.
That makes sense. So in a way, because I was going to ask, in your essays on like Jung on values, being there's like different kinds of values that he spoke about, and it sounds like, okay, maybe he's a moral relativist, but at the same time, if everyone like the path to individuation leads people to adopt a similar set of values or principles, such as I'm not going to harm this person or do unto others as you would have them do unto you. So in that way, there's perhaps objective morality or values, but it's also relative on how you get there.
Mm-hmm.
Is that accurate?
That's right. Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's helpful to think about.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. And again, forgive me for jumping all around. This is not.
That's fine. I don't mind.
I was just thinking, you've moved to Zoom in a lot of ways, and I know that tech is a four-letter word to you. But do you record any of your courses to where?
Hmm.
Yeah.
Oh,
to
yeah.
Where, yeah. Okay.
Oh, yeah. Now that Zoom allows us to record and then I can send them to the students, I also send them to our tech guys, and they're putting all this stuff on the website. And people can, you know, look and, you know, I think they buy them. I don't get into much of that stuff, but they're available. And yes, they're all recorded.
Okay.
Well,
awesome.
I say that. The dream groups are never recorded because dreams are a very private thing. And the very first time we have a course, I say, you know, this is like Las Vegas. Okay. What's said here stays here. And so those are never recorded. But the classes like Reading Jung, the one we're doing now for 9 weeks, 9 months rather, that's recorded and they'll all be available.
Okay. Well, 9 months. That's 9 months.
Well, they're reading not the whole 20 volumes here, but they're reading, let's see, 4, 5, 6, 7, 10, 16, 17. They're reading 7 of the 20 volumes.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. All right. And it's taking 9 months because they have a whole month to read, you know, a book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Fascinating. Do you have a favorite? You've been doing this for quite a while. Is there any I don't know, favorite memories or moments that stand out to you, or favorite aspects of your work, something like that?
Well, the teaching is always a pleasure. And here, because I never have to give exams, I don't have to grade people. We work to create a safe environment. There's a, you know, relaxed environment. So that's fun.
Yeah.
And then sometimes the students, I'll give you an example. It was last spring, we ran the course on the path of individuation. And everybody toward the end said, we don't want it to end. We don't want it to end. This is sometimes the case. The class just gels and the subject is great. And they didn't want it to end. And I said, well, I'll see. I'll write in my dream journal, as I do, for guidance as to whether or not we should have another rendition. And if so, you know, what would it be? So I wrote in the dream journal. And then I know enough to know I have to sort of wait because things are incubating. That was on our class was Monday. We had Tuesday. So Saturday, I'm sitting at this is the machine that's quarantined. And I was about to write another blog essay. And I have my fingers on the keyboard and suddenly they're working. And I am aware that it's not the blog essay at all. And over 5 hours, that entire second course came out.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was a very, well, I mean, I've had these periodically, but that's when that happens, you know, you really feel like there is some support for the process of what we're doing here. Those are very nice times. That was the easiest course I think I ever created. And I tell the people, I don't take any credit here.
Wow, that's amazing. So Sometimes I've attempted to read certain work by Jung, and even some of like the probably the easier things. Like I know if someone tries to read the Red Book or something, there's a whole lot of people that are trying to understand that book, right? But some of his maybe lower level works, even when you're reading it, it's like, I feel like I understand what he's trying to say, but I'm not sure that I'm interpreting it correctly, or that I understand correctly what he's trying to say here. And I thought it would be super helpful if there was some books dedicated to interpreting Jung. Do you?
Well, he himself admitted that as he was an INTP, and those t as a type, they generally are not the easiest people to read because they're not really focused on the reader understanding what's saying. They're writing for themselves. And he was very, very quick to admit that he didn't really write well. And it is true, there are lots of stuff he's written, even forget about the alchemy. I mean, that's really off the board. But he recognized, this isn't necessarily all that clear. The stuff that is clear was stuff that he participated in, but that other people actually heavily edited, like his Memories, Dreams, Reflections, his memoir. But it really was, he would relate memories he had to Anna Yaleafi, his secretary, and she would take it down. Then the two of them would go back and clean it up. And then that book is pretty accessible.
Yeah, I wonder either if you know anybody, or I think that would be a great task for someone to undertake, is to have some like study aids to certain of his collected works, you know?
Yeah, that was the endeavor of the Reading Jung course. I wanted people to begin to get into reading him. We started with Memories, Dreams, Reflections, and then we did Jung Speaking, which was a collection of memoirs of people who met Jung, and that described him as a man. And in some cases, it's actually recorded interviews that were then transcribed, but he's speaking. So, that's pretty easy. And then you have things like his dream seminar, his children's dream seminar. There are a variety of seminars he gave where he was speaking with people. And if they couldn't follow, they'd raise their hand, professor, can you, clarify? And then he would, do that. So they're accessible. And then the other things I took slowly as we got through the not all of the 20 volumes, but some of the more accessible, the students were beginning to get into the sense of his style.
That's super helpful.
Yeah, I don't think I lost anyone.
Well, I'll have to I'll add a link of your website into the description of my video, so anybody watching this and being introduced to you can just click on that, and they'll find the Jungian Center for Spiritual Sciences, and they can sign up for some of these courses.
Very good, thanks.
Good. Yeah. And I guess last question, is there anything that comes to mind that maybe I didn't ask about, or that you feel like sharing, whether about yourself or about your work or about Jung, before we end here?
Well, yeah, I think that I would like to leave people with the idea that Jung is more and more coming to the fore. Because in the years since 2005, I've observed more people doing podcasts with Jung, having courses, various of the Jung Institutes running programs for the general public, I think Jung is really beginning to come more and more into his, you know, the mainstream. And I think, you know, that's all to the good, because I think he has very important things to say. And many people are able to sort of translate him into, you know, more colloquial English to make his ideas accessible. And I'm very gratified by that.
Yeah. And it's, I'm sure that you are proud to think and to say that you've had a part in that.
I would like to think so.
Yeah.
A small part.
Yeah.
I don't want to do great things. I'm just trying to do small things, because he was big about small. You want to stay small. You want to stay loose. When Joe Henderson and Joe Wheelrock left, because the war was starting, and they went back to San Francisco, they told him they were going to set up an institute, and he said, keep it loose, keep it loose. Yeah.
What do you think it is about the current climate that has brought Jung to the fore?
People's quest for meaning. People's quest for empowerment. I think also the recognition that there's more than stuff, you know, materialism, consumeritis.
Yeah.
I think people are searching for some spiritual toehold, and Jung offers that.
Well, Sue, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for joining me and lasting through my haphazard questioning style.